This is the Blue Dot Report Special. I'm Dave Shlohm, and I'm with Dave McComas, Principal Investigator for the IBEX spacecraft, the Interstellar Boundary Explorer. And we've been talking about the heliosphere. Dave, I'd like to talk to about you a little bit. Tell us about how you got started as a child. What first interested you in the sciences?
Well, sure, Dave. So it turns out that I'm pretty dyslexic, and I didn't learn to read very well as a kid. Didn't actually learn to read much at all till fourth grade, and I'm still quite a poor reader. But I was interested in all sorts of other things, and so I found that, you know, when other kids were learning to read and spending their time doing that, I would mostly go down in the basement or out in the backyard, depending on the season, and I'd be inventing things and making things and dreaming things up. And so I think I always, from the start, thought, you know, you can do technical stuff. You can do, you know, you can do things that require your hands or inventing something new. And then, as you know, once I learned to read at some level and did a lot of math and other things through school, it became apparent to me in high school, basically, that physics was just, you know, the best possible thing for me. I mean, it really turned me on. In physics, you can explain the world around you, and, you know, it's not mysterious. It's not magical. I mean, it is magical, but, you know, it's magic that you can understand, and there are physical laws that allow you to understand this, and there are things that you can do that nobody's done before that are based on the same physical laws. You just haven't discovered how to do that particular thing yet. So it's really interesting and fascinating to me, and through the process of high school, I worked hard on really developing the math skills the best I could, and the reading to the extent that I could, and then trying to understand, you know, physics and the physical world around us.
Were you ever able to get any extra help with your reading disability?
Well, back
in school.
Yeah, I'm 55. Back in the days that I was in those grades, I don't think dyslexia was understood very well and wasn't really tested for. One of my children is quite dyslexic, and we were able to identify it when he was six. And, you know, he's been able to get extra help all the way along, although my wife and I have had to be very proactive, you know, working with the public schools to get him the support he needs. I think in this day and age, you know, those options are available, and the public schools owe you that extra help if that's what you really need. And so I would encourage anybody who's having those problems these days, you know, to get tested and get the help they need.
So from high school, then where?
So I went to MIT from high school. I didn't have the best grades because my reading wasn't the greatest. But I had actually made a small company as a high schooler. I made jewelry, and I did lapidary work, grinding stones, and I'd make silver, mostly silver jewelry, and I'd sell it at the Christmas fairs and that sort of thing. And I think that when MIT was looking at students, I mean, you know, they get a lot of students with, you know, very good academics and good math and good this, that, and the other. I don't think, at least when I got there in 1976, I don't think they'd had a lot of students who'd run a successful business for 3 years. And so my guess is that that's how I got accepted. And it was just a great experience. I mean, really smart, fabulous teachers, professors, and also other students to work with. So very challenging and enriching environment.
Did you ever have Walter Lewin as a professor?
No. I know of him, but I didn't have him personally. Mm-hmm.
So his MIT lectures are one of the neatest things you can watch on YouTube.
Right.
Physics is just it's my favorite subject because it just enables you to understand the beauty that's all around you on a very deep level. It's the more you understand about physics, the more beautiful it becomes, I think.
Absolutely.
So from MIT, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in space science.
While I was at MIT, I actually started to be involved. MIT has a very good program for undergraduates to start research in their junior year, typically. And so I did research my junior and senior years and the summer in between at the Center for Space Physics there. I was working with a graduate student who was developing a sounding rocket to do some soft X-ray imaging. And so I helped out with that. It turned out that the skills I had in precision work from my jewelry-making business were very valuable. in the lab trying to help develop, you know, this aerospace instrumentation. And so I worked there for the last two years that I was an undergrad at MIT. And from there, I found a job at Los Alamos National Laboratory, working in the space sciences there with a very excellent senior person who was designing instrumentation for the what's now known as the Ulysses spacecraft, which flew over the poles of the sun. And I basically did what I like to describe as a kind of a classic, like, you know, the people who do the samurai swords. Instead of a book learning education, they go and they become apprentice. I mean, a true apprentice. And I like to think of what I did my first couple years at Los Alamos as actually apprenticeship. I put my desk directly in the lab where the senior person that I was working with was doing the design and developing the hardware. And, you know, I watched and helped in everything that was done. And over the course of a couple years, I knew an awful lot about building spaceflight instrumentation.
For our listeners who may not be aware of it, briefly tell them, what is the Southwest Research Institute?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit. We do research and development. I came here to Southwest in 2000 after 20 years at Los Alamos. I've been here 13 years. We have over 3,000 employees, and we do technical development for both the government and for other private companies, roughly 50-50, across a broad range of technical areas from automotive to aerospace, national security, fuels and lubricants. I mean, just a broad range of technical things that we help people out with.
For a youngster that may be out there listening to you right now, what advice would you give for somebody that wants to pursue a career like yours?
I would say the best bit of advice that I could give is question everything and don't let anybody tell you that you can't do it. I hear a lot of people will tell you you can't do this or you can't do that, or they know how something works and this is the way it is. And I think by maintaining an attitude, one, that the people who've gone before you don't necessarily know everything, and two, anything that they can do, you can do, and maybe you can do it even better. And maintaining that sort of strong attitude about, you know, what you want to accomplish in your career and just going for it is probably the single best advice I could give.
Let's talk about a little bit about NASA space science, because as I mentioned in the opening, you're on the NASA Advisory Council, and you're the chairman of the Science Committee now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What are some of the future directions that you see NASA going with space science?
Well, there are a lot of really exciting areas in space science right now. We've talked so far on this show just about sort of the outer heliosphere. But there's a much broader range of what we call heliophysics, which includes not just the solar wind and outer heliosphere, but the study of the sun, the study of these ejections and things that cause the space weather that we talked about, the interaction of the space environment with the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and then all sorts of other interactions around other planets. They're very interesting regions and interactions that are somewhat the same but somewhat different at, say, Saturn and Jupiter and the other planets. Then there's all of astrophysics. I mean, the incredible images that we get back from the Hubble Space Telescope. We're in the middle of developing JWST, which is the next great observatory that's going to go up and take, you know, even more stellar sorts of images of a variety of different objects. We're doing actual missions out to other planets. We've got a spacecraft right now on its way to Jupiter, just actually had Earth fly by last week, and is now on its way out to Jupiter, a mission called Juno, which is going to go into a polar orbit around Jupiter and study Jupiter in detail, try to understand the origin of Jupiter, which is very important because it's actually the second largest body in the solar system after the sun. And so a lot of the history of understanding our solar system should come out of understanding Jupiter in detail. And so other planetary missions that we're doing. And then there's a lot we're doing in Earth sciences. And, you know, I think there's been a growing appreciation for just how important our own environment here on Earth is and how well we can study that, how it changes, how it evolves, how one aspect connects to another through space observations. And so we've had a growing program and really excellent observations from space of the Earth environment, its atmosphere, and other things. And so there's a lot of really good scientific content there and a lot of really interesting missions coming down the pike. We've talked a little about Solar Probe. I mean, there's a mission we're in the middle of development right now, launches in 2018, flies within 10 solar radii of the corona. If you've ever seen an eclipse picture, you see the corona extending out that far. Imagine a spacecraft flying through that close in and measuring directly the solar material coming up off the solar surface into the corona. And so, I mean, there's just a lot of really fascinating things going on with our existing missions, where we continue to get really good data and continue to make very important discoveries, and with new missions that we're out in the process of developing and hoping to start developing over the next few years.
One of the things that I enjoy about doing this program every week for 4 minutes and talking to people like you is to try to bring your work to our listeners, whether they be at work or in their car on the way home or to work or in their living room, or the guy I love to think of as the guy on his tractor or somewhere near Alturas listening on his stereo inside his tractor as he's harvesting alfalfa or something, finding out about science. Why do you think it's important for people like you to spend time with us communicating about your work?
Well, I don't think we do science just for ourselves. I mean, I know there are people who think, you know, you discover something and that's the end of it. But from my perspective as a scientist, my job isn't done until I've written a technical paper and gotten it published and told the rest of the community, the scientific community, you know, what it is that we've discovered and how it is that this piece of the physical universe works that wasn't understood before that. So communication is a really, really important aspect. From my own personal perspective, it's broader. I mean, we need to take that same kind of message in words that hopefully people can understand out to the broader public who, frankly, you know, are affected by the science, don't always know about it, but are affected by the science, and who ultimately fund the science. I mean, the work that I've been describing today came out of NASA missions, you know, which are funded through your tax dollars and my tax dollars. And so, you know, it's a really important part of the whole to go back and try to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it and why it's important.
And briefly, why is it important to do space science for us here on Earth? What is the biggest values, you know, if you're trying to convince somebody that thinks, well, why should we spend the money on that? Why is it important?
I always answer that in two parts. There are some really important aspects in terms of real-life implications for us here on Earth, especially in our increasingly technological society. Large solar storms are a good example of something that can just wreak havoc with our technological society. You were talking about the farmer who's out there with his tractor. A lot of farmers these days have GPS in their tractor, and the tractor's sort of driving itself. When the GPS gets screwed up and you go across your fence at the edge of the field instead of down the road that you intended to be on, it's a major problem. And more things are sort of using these technological capabilities that we have. And so there's a very practical side to what we do. But even more than that, there's the side of exploration. And by exploration, I don't mean, you know, a person going somewhere to see something themselves. I mean actually exploring as a scientist explores, learning new things about our universe that nobody ever knew before. I mean, this is a calling for humanity that we've always had, and it's a really important aspect of what differentiates us from all of the animals. You know, we want to understand our place in the universe. We want to understand how we got to be the way we are and how we fit in the broader context of this. And as a scientist, you know, we're really embedded in those sorts of very important and very broad issues.
Well, Dave, I know you're a very, very busy man, and I know you've got important work to do. I want to thank you for taking this time to spend with us today, because I know it's valuable time, and you've been wonderful. We've really appreciated it.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Dave McComas. He's the principal investigator for the Interstellar Boundary Explorer spacecraft and one of the country's leading space scientists. I'm Dave Schlom, reminding you that we all live on a pale blue dot.